People of Earth, attention. This is a voice speaking to you from thousands of miles beyond your planet.
This is the Skywatch Hour, and I'm your host, Jim Hickman.
It starts so innocently. You look into the sky, and your life changes forever. If you think we're alone, think again. Skywatch International. Information you can trust.
...72% of Americans think the government is lying about UFOs. Log on to freedomofinfo.org and find out why.
Join the search for answers. Join MUFON. You have an opportunity to help find the truth by joining America's oldest and largest civilian organization devoted to UFO reports. Obtain solid information on recent UFO events from on-site investigations. Learn what the U.S. government said on record about alien visitations and what MUFON is doing to foster an open discussion and further disclosures. With your membership, you receive 12 issues of the MUFON Journal and a formal application. Get started today. www.mufon.com.
As Hurricane Katrina threatened our Gulf Coast, ham radio was on the air, saving lives. As Katrina's winds raged, ham radio got the message through. As Katrina's waters surged, ham radio worked when other communications failed. And ham radio is working now, helping rescuers, comforting victims, uniting communities. To learn how you can become a ham radio operator, call the ARRL, the National Organization for Amateur Radio, at 800-326-3942 or visit ARRL.org.
Have you always wanted to know the truth about things like UFOs, underground bases, Area 51, the Great Pyramid at Giza, and the Roswell incident of 1947? If so, look no further than Dennis Ballfaser's cutting-edge research. There's no woo-woo factor here, folks, just the facts as he researched them. Dennis's lectures are available on video and audio cassette. For more information and free access to Dennis's research, visit his website, www.truthseekeratroswell.com. That's truthseekeratroswell.com. The truth is here.
Headline edition, July 8, 1947. The Army Air Forces has announced that a flying disc has been found and is now in the possession of the Army. Army officers say the missile, found sometime last week, has been inspected at Roswell, New Mexico, and sent to Wright Field, Ohio, for further inspection.
Stranger than land, stranger than sea. I was driving my car on a lonesome road. Then what happened made my mind explode. I was abducted by aliens. Oh. To my surprise, rocking with the aliens was a sight to see. Rocking with the aliens, the aliens to me.
And good afternoon, evening, whatever it is in your part of the world. In my part of the world, we call this show the Skywatch Hour. I'm your host, Jim Hickman. For the next, 56 minutes, we're going to talk about UFOs, as we usually do on this time on Thursday nights. As you know, I'm a ufologist. I've been doing this a little over 30 years, and we're going to give you a little insight, a behind-the-scenes look at how we look at UFOs, how we investigate them, how we look at this whole phenomenon. I'm the executive director of Skywatch International, one of the world's largest UFO groups, and my whole purpose working with Skywatch is to investigate and educate. And this show is about the education. And we're going to talk a little bit, as you heard, the Roswell crash broadcast there just a minute ago. That's what we're going to be talking about a little later in the show, is Roswell crash debris and other interesting crashes that have happened with UFOs over the last, 100 years or so. And it should be a very interesting show. I think you folks will really enjoy the show and might even entertain you a little bit. What we're going to do first off is take you back in history a little bit. And I guess we should probably talk about one of the more famous crashes. But I think before we do that, we better go back and talk about this week's highlights in UFOs. Then we'll go talk about our main topic this week. You know, there's a major sighting down in Florida this last week, and people are talking about that pretty much all over the country. Literally thousands of people saw something that was described as a fireball fly through the sky, and this was seen. I don't know exactly what people are what they're saying this is or what it isn't, as far as whether it was a UFO. I think it was still an unknown object. But we don't know what we're dealing with this unknown object. Once again, we get this quite often. There's a video of it available online, and so we're going to see what's going on with it. We got people looking at it throughout the country. Channel 6 News down in Florida, in Jacksonville, I believe, is the people that got this story out for us. They're describing this as a mysterious ball of fire seen in the Florida skies. Dozens of people from Jacksonville to Fort Pierce flooded the U.S. Coast Guard late Tuesday. Calls about a mysterious ball of fire seen flying in the sky. Callers flooded the newsroom of local News 6 after they saw the object over the Space Coast Tuesday night. Starting about 7:30 last night, we started receiving calls here in the newsroom. In fact, the Coast Guard station in Port Canaveral got more than 24 reports of people seeing a bright light in the sky over the ocean. From Fort Pierce to about 5 miles south of Jacksonville, reports came in to Coast Guard offices starting about 7:30, said Dan Yates, a Coast Guard petty officer in Port Canaveral. Yates said one caller who was walking his dog near the Sebastian Inlet described the object as a huge like a fireball. It's a caller to the Coast Guard station thought a boater might be in trouble. A lot of people thought it might have been a flare that might have gone up. One person thought this fireball went into the ocean. The Coast Guard said it probably didn't, and it was just his perspective. We know it was not a rocket launch, and we know the Air Force was not doing anything. That's an understatement. Experts say it could be a piece of space junk or a large meteor burning up in the atmosphere. I wonder which experts that is. The Coast Guard near Jacksonville also received calls. A Ferris spokesman for Patrick Air Force Base says no local military activity was taking place Tuesday night. And we want to thank Channel 6 News for that interesting story. And I would like to have some quote-unquote experts look at that story a little bit better than what their so-called experts. So I think there's could be a little bit more to that than just dismissing it right offhand as being space junk. We need to go look at NORAD's tracking data before we can call it space junk. But always leave it to the experts to jump to whatever conclusion they can find, whatever fits their theories. So we'll see. We'll be looking at that as we go along over the next few weeks. That's probably the highlight of this last few shows, I think. A pretty good deal. Pretty good sighting. We usually try to give you as many sightings reports as we can throughout the show. I hope you enjoy listening to it and listening to what we talk about. There's a lot of things going on in the world. I think we're going to take you back here in time in a few minutes and give you some reports from the old days. And first off, I think we should go back, way back. How about, say, 1897? That might be pretty good. 1897 is a pretty good year for UFOs. As you know, we had a huge flap, just a huge flap of UFO sightings in 1897. This is all the United States. Some are seen in Europe. Some are seen in Australia. So this is amazing stuff. Our first crash story we're going to talk about today is from a Thai town called Aurora, Texas. This case happened in 1897. Aurora, Texas was the town that almost was, and almost isn't now. Very small town just outside of Fort Worth, Texas. It's about to disappear due to expansion and the building of a large interstate highway down there. So we're going to try to get this story out as much as we can, not only here, but on the History Channel TV shows. We're going to try and recreate this show. This town purports to have a burial site of an alien pilot that crashed there in 1897. And they have a cemetery, and it has a historical marker that includes their spacecraft crash story in the Aurora Cemetery. So we'll talk about a little bit about this. I'll just give you the story as it was put out in the local newspapers. Some people say that this is a hoax brought out to bring fame and fortune to the people and the town of Aurora. Well, if that's the case, it didn't work at all. So I don't think so. A big newspaper like the Dallas Morning News would not put out a story that they hadn't done at least a little bit of research. But let's go ahead and read this story as it happened. This is from the April 19th edition of the Dallas Morning News, written 1897. About 6 o'clock this morning, the early risers of Aurora were astonished at the sudden appearance of the airship, which had been sailing around the country. As you know, they've had multiple sightings of these airships. It was traveling due north and much nearer the earth than seen before. Evidently, some of the machinery was out of order, for it was making a speed of only 10 to 12 miles an hour, and gradually set towards the earth. It sailed over the public square. When it reached the north part of town, it collided with the tower of Judge Proctor's windmill. It went into pieces with a terrific explosion, scattering debris over several acres of ground, wrecking the windmill and a water tank, and destroying the judge's flower garden. The pilot of the ship is supposed to have been the only one aboard. And while his remains are badly disfigured, enough of the original has been picked up to show that he's not an inhabitant of this world. T.J. Weems, the U.S. Army's Signal Service officer, an authority on astronomy, gives his opinion that the pilot was a native of the planet Mars. Papers found on his person, evidently the records of his travels, are written in some unknown hieroglyphics. It cannot be deciphered. The ship is too badly wrecked to form any conclusion as to its construction or motive power. It was built of an unknown metal, resembling a mixture of aluminum and silver, and must have weighed several tons. The town is today full of people who are viewing the wreckage and gathering specimens of strange metal from the debris. The pilot's funeral will take place tomorrow. The article was written by E. Hayden, who is a part-time reporter for the Morning News. Startling as that news was, no other newspapers in the world ran that story in their papers. News of the incident remained dormant for almost a century until May 24, 1973, when newspapers around the country published the following United Press International account. Dateline Aurora, Texas, UPI. A grave in the small North Texas cemetery contains the body of an 1897 astronaut who was not an inhabitant of this world, according to the International UFO Bureau. The group which investigates unidentified flying objects has already initiated legal proceedings to exhume the body and will go to court if necessary to open the grave, Director Hayden Hughes said Wednesday. After checking the grave with metal detectors and gathering facts for 3 months, we are certain as we can be at this point that he was the pilot of a UFO which reportedly exploded atop a well on Judge J.S. Proctor's place April 19, 1897, Hughes said. He was not an inhabitant of this world. A few days later, another UPI account, Dateline Aurora, quoted a 91-year-old who had been a girl of 15 in Aurora at the time of the reported incident. Said she had all but forgotten the incident until it appeared in the newspapers recently. She said her parents had gone to the site of the crash, but had refused to take her along. She recalled that the remains of the pilot, a small man as she remembered, had been buried in the Aurora Cemetery. Not to be outdone, the Associated Press, in a story datelined Denton, Texas, reported that a North Texas State University professor had found some metal fragments near the Oaks Gate gas station, which is now the former Proctor Farm. One fragment was said to be most intriguing because it consisted of primarily iron, which did not seem to exhibit magnetic properties. Iron without magnetic properties. Okay. The professor also said he was puzzled because the fragment was shiny and malleable instead of dull and brittle like iron. The Aurora Cemetery Association was successful in blocking the attempts to dig up the grounds in the search of the, quote, Martian pilot, unquote. The incident will probably go underground again until its centennial, which will bring around another round of widespread press coverage. Well, in 1997, I made my first field investigation down in Aurora, Texas, just north of Fort Worth. And the results of our research down there were weird, to say the least. One of the first things you notice when you arrive in Aurora is the traces of the military presence everywhere in town. This place even boasts a military-type airport from the 40s era. Even the streets of town laid up in base fashion. The cemetery is built on a road. The road's name is called, remarkably, Old Base Road. The military says they've never had a base in Aurora. Nobody claims that there ever was. We have no records that there were. But yet, there it is. You take a look at an aerial photo from Google or any of these websites that have these aerial map displays, and you can clearly see that there was and still is evidence of an airport. Why would the military want to have a base in Aurora, I asked myself, especially back then. Well, if my memory's correct, I believe the Roswell crash debris was flown directly to Fort Worth, Texas, from Roswell, which is less than 10 miles as the crow flies from Aurora. I don't think that's a coincidence. Could the military have had an alien recovery base set up and running from back 100 years ago in Aurora? I'm beginning to wonder. This is something we need to look at. Almost the entire town from those days is gone. They replaced modern buildings, modern subdivisions, but the town cemetery is still there. We've visited the cemetery. There's no sign of the tombstone anymore. It was stolen years ago and never recovered. There are picture records of its existence, and we do have a photo of it. There's a movement in town to exhume the body of the alien, replace the headstone, and do a complete search for the remains of the crash. There have been several interesting pieces of metal found in the area that have been confiscated for analysis by the military and never returned. As we say, Aurora, another unsolved mystery. And maybe with our upcoming History Channel show on the subject, we can solve this mystery of the Aurora crash. Okay, this show this week is going to be a little bit on crashes like that. We're going to go into some history of crashes, reported crashes, and talk a little bit about recent cases, and just whatever you'd like to talk about. If you'd like to have a question answered on the show, just send me an email. My email address is director@skywatch-international.org. And send it to me, attention Jim Hickman, and I will answer your questions here live on the air. So, we're going to talk a little more about cases on crash cases. I hope you enjoy what we talk about on this stuff. The very next case, I'm looking for a report here, folks, but I can't find it. So we're going to go on with some reports that we have already listed here. It's a synopsis of UFO crash reports, military retrievals. Skywatch was formed by a gentleman by the name of Colonel Steve Wilson, who's involved in military crash retrievals for many years, before he passed away in 1997, mysteriously. So, we have a long history of crash retrieval investigations in Skywatch, and we continue that to this day. Many of these reports we're going to talk about tonight have not been investigated and need to be the subject of future research. And as you heard in the opening segment of the show, they kind of crashed in Roswell, New Mexico, back on around July 4th, 1947. Probably the most famous UFO crash cases ever in history, and probably the most thoroughly investigated. I myself have been to Roswell many times. I've spoke down there. I've visited, made many friends. I think maybe an upcoming show will play one of the interviews that I did with some witnesses there at Roswell. We did a live show from the museum in Roswell, right on the stage there. And see if we can't get some of that show on the air here, because it hasn't been broadcast very often. It's kind of a special deal, and there's a lot of good information there. We had Dennis Balthizer and Julie Schlusler from the museum with us. We interviewed a lot of good people, met thousands of people as they made it through the museum during that holiday weekend. So I'm sure you're familiar with the Roswell case. I'll give you just a real brief overview and then my opinion on it. A gentleman named William, everybody calls him Mac Brazel, was a local rancher at that time. Nowadays, before he passed away, he was the largest producer of meat and beef for the United States government in the world. But he, at that time, he was a local rancher, was the foreman of a ranch there in New Mexico, north of Roswell. He reported he heard a loud explosion during the night of a thunderstorm. The next day, he found a debris field over his ranch. Word reached Major Jesse Marcel. Oh, I should mention that he heard that loud explosion during the night of a thunderstorm. If you go to the news page that everybody looks at on the Roswell crash, you know, where Army recovers flying saucer, that one, there's a story there, I think, that has been hidden in plain sight. And we might as well bring that out while we're talking here. Sort of a hidden Roswell story that kind of corroborates his statement. And I think that might be kind of interesting to go over that. We call this one the Missing Roswell Report. And this is the Daily Record, Tuesday, July 8th, 1947. RAAF captures flying saucer on ranch in Roswell region. It's an eyewitness report of UFOs flying over the town of Roswell on the evening before the more famous crash report. The story remained hidden in plain sight on the front page of the Roswell newspaper since 1947. Seems everyone sees the headline, but no one reads the rest of the story. That was my Paul Harvey interpretation. Let me quote you from the report. A Mr. and Mrs. Dan Wilmot apparently were the only persons in Roswell who had seen what they thought was a flying disc. And I offer this report in proof that something did fly over Roswell, New Mexico, and may have crashed there later that night. All right, the headline. Roswell hardware man and his wife reports disc seen. The intelligence office of the 509th Bombardment Group, Roswell Army Airfield, announced at noon today that the field has come in possession of a flying saucer. According to information released by the department, over authority of Major Jesse A. Marcel, intelligence officer, the disc was recovered on a ranch in the Roswell vicinity after an unidentified rancher had notified Sheriff George Wilcox here that he found the instrument on his premise. Major Marcel and a detail from his department went to the ranch and recovered the disc, it was stated. After the intelligence officer here had inspected the instrument, it was flown to higher headquarters. The intelligence office stated that no details of the saucer's construction or its appearance had been revealed. Mr. and Mrs. Dan Wilmot apparently were the only persons in Roswell who had seen what they thought was a flying disc. They were sitting on their porch at 105 South Penn last Wednesday night, about 10 o'clock, when a large glowing object zoomed out of the sky from the southeast, going in a northwesterly direction at a high rate of speed. Wilmot called Mrs. Wilmot's attention to it, and both ran down into the yard to watch. It was in sight less than a minute, perhaps 40 or 50 seconds, Wilmot estimated. Wilmot said it appeared to him to be about 1,500 feet high and going fast. He estimated between 400 and 500 miles an hour. In appearance, it looked oval in shape like two inverted saucers faced mouth-to-mouth, or like two old-type washbowls placed together in the same fashion. The entire body glowed as though light were showing through from inside, though not like it would be light that was merely underneath. From where he stood, Wilmot said the object looked to be about 5 feet in size. Making allowance of distance from town, he figured it must have been 15 to 20 feet in diameter, though this was just a guess. Wilmot said he heard no sound, but that Mrs. Wilmot said she heard a swishing sound for a very short time. The object came into view from the southeast and disappeared over the treetops of the general vicinity of Six Mile Hill. Wilmot is one of the most respected and reliable citizens in town. He kept the story to himself, hoping that someone else would come out and tell about having seen one. But finally, today, decided to go ahead and tell about it. The announcement that the RAAF was in possession of one came only a few minutes after he decided to release the details of what he had seen. Okay, now that's on the front page of the paper, the same paper that gives us the story of the Roswell crash. Interesting, huh? And if you look at his sighting, from the southeast to northwest, that is exactly the track that this object was supposed to have taken. I've been on the porch of his house there on Pennsylvania Avenue. I've done some trajectory work with what he's seen, and it all correlates nicely with what the other witnesses have seen and reported. Right, back to this original report. Word reached Major Jesse Marcel. I've been to the Major's house. I know his son quite well, Jesse Jr. Jesse's in Iraq right now. He's a last I heard, he's a major in the Army flying helicopters. He's also a doctor. I've been to the house, seen the room that they supposedly looked at the metal from the debris from this object in the kitchen. Interesting enough, Jesse's mom, Mac Brazel's wife, has just recently come out and supported their report on this case. She too also saw the debris. So we have another eyewitness. Well, anyway, word reached Marcel at the Roswell Army Airfield, and he went out and investigated. He reported finding a debris field scattered over a mile. The material recovered from the debris includes small beams with hieroglyphics on them, metal that was as light as balsa wood but couldn't be dented with a sledgehammer, but flexible. We call that memory metal today. You may have that in your classes or have it on some piece of equipment. It's quite common. The material will not burn. The scrap metal was flown to Carswell Air Force Base in Fort Worth. And that's important for our Aurora story. It's given the materials flown to Carswell Air Force Base in Fort Worth. Witnesses have described a second site where the main body of the craft was found, along with the bodies of its crew. All right. Interesting stuff. We should probably just really, while we're sitting here on the Roswell story, we should probably talk just a little bit more about it. And I think we will. I'm trying to make my mind up if I want to do this on the air here now. I guess we can. Why not? In my new book that's coming out very soon, we have a chapter called The Lindbergh UFO Files. Seems that the same Charles Lindbergh that flew across the Atlantic was very interested in UFOs and was seen in Roswell the day of the crash on the base with generals. So we'll give you a little background on this story. And you got to remember that we live in a world where dreams and reality interchange. That's from Charles Lindbergh. It's one of his quotes. And with things we found from our research so far was that there is a military group called the Kilner-Lindbergh Board. It's dedicated to studying foreign aircraft in the U.S. as early as 1939, perhaps as part of the Army Counterintelligence Corps. And they seem to have been involved in UFO recoveries. Charles Lindbergh was a member of that group, and he was very interested in rockets. And it was a friend of Dr. Goddard, who amazingly did his research in Roswell from the early 30s through 1947. Lindbergh had a high security clearance throughout World War II and after. His anti-war activities now seem to be a cover-up act to keep his group's identity secure. General Roger Ramey was in Roswell and not Fort Worth on the day of the flying disc recovery, in contradiction to the reports at the time, per eyewitness's affidavit. Charles Lindbergh was on the base at Roswell with General Ramey. Two eyewitnesses, including Dr. Jesse Marcel, saw him entering the officers' club and even remember the color of the suit he was wearing. Jesse told me that he was wearing a bright blue suit, and that his dad, Jesse Marcel Sr., pointed out to him that that was the famous Charles Lindbergh. So the kid didn't forget that when he was a child, or Jesse didn't when he was a kid, and he remembers that to this day. Don Kehoe, the famous Don Kehoe, NICAP, the famous investigator, was Charles Lindbergh's aide, his military aide, from 1927 on. He's involved in all the activities, showing why it's such an intense desire to get to the truth about UFOs. And interestingly, the crash debris from Roswell could not have been flown to Wright Field, as some reports had stated. Wright Field's runways were closed during that time for modernization. So as you can see, there's some serious problems with the whole Roswell story, starting right from here. Charles Lindbergh was involved in or in charge of a UFO recovery operation. This is my speculation. That operated worldwide, especially in the U.S., under an organization similar, if not the same, as MJ-12. He worked with this group from at least the 1920s to at least after July 1947. All right, and interesting enough, in Fort Worth, we get a report. Brigadier General Roger Ramey says it's being shipped by air to the AAF Research Center at Wright Field, Ohio. Uh-huh. And then the report says, a few moments ago, I talked to the officials at Wright Field, and they declared that they were expecting the so-called flying saucer to be delivered there. But that hasn't arrived as yet. And the report goes on. In the meantime, General Ramey described the object as being a flimsy construction, almost like a box kite. He says it was so battered that he was unable to determine whether it had a disc form. He does not indicate its size. Ramey says, as far as he can be determined, no one saw the object in the air. Is that right? Well, we have witnesses who described the object in the air. So he's wrong there, too. He describes it as being made of some sort of tinfoil. Other Army officials say the further information indicates the object had a diameter of 20 to 25 feet. Nothing in the apparent construction indicated any capacity for speed, and there is no evidence of a power plant. The disc also appeared to be too flimsy to carry a man. General Ramey is featured in my second book called The Alien Menace. And this is a little background on him. This is his story, as we're led to believe. You may remember him posing with the crash debris back in 1947 in Fort Worth. On the morning of July 8th, Marcel reported we had found Colonel Blanchard, showing him pieces of the wreckage, none of which looked anything like Blanchard had seen. Blanchard then sent Marcel to Carswell, Army Airfield, to see General Ramey, commanding officer of the 8th Air Force. Marcel stated years later to Walter Haut that he had taken some of the debris into Ramey's office to show him what he had found. The material was displayed on Ramey's desk for the general when he returned. Upon his return, General Ramey wanted to see the exact location of the debris field, so he and Marcel went to the map down the hall, map room, but when they returned, the wreckage that had been placed on the desk was gone, and a weather balloon was spread out on the floor. A Major Charles A. Cashin took the now famous photo of Marcel with the weather balloon in General Ramey's office. It's then reported that General Ramey recognized the remains as part of the weather balloon. Brigadier General Thomas Du Bois, the chief of the staff of the 8th Air Force, said it was a cover story. The whole balloon part, that was the part of the story we were told to give to the public and news, and that was it. A cover story. The military tried to convince the news media from that day forward the object found near Roswell was nothing more than a weather balloon. Roger Ramey worked as an officer at Roswell Army Air Base in 1947. Ramey was the officer who immediately ordered a second press release saying it was a weather balloon that's in the desert, not a UFO, as the first press release said. All the concerned people who were also ordered by Ramey not to speak to reporters about the incident. Pretty strange stuff. Pretty strange. Anyway, Dr. Goddard was involved in this. Of course, he's the father of modern rocketry. His test stands were in Roswell. And for them to say that people didn't know what, for them to say that they didn't know what a rocket was in Roswell's is patently ridiculous. They obviously do know about rockets. He was in town at the coffee shop pretty much on a daily basis, his crews. So yeah, every time they saw something in the sky in the 40s, 30s, they said, there's another one of Goddard's rockets. So, it's just an interesting background here. Alright, the rest of the story kind of goes like this. Several people reported they saw Charles Lindbergh at Roswell during the crash activity in July 47, including my friend Dr. Jesse Marcel Jr. He wrote to me, "Yes, I saw Lindbergh at the officers' club at the airbase. We were eating dinner when my dad pointed out that the tall gentleman in a blue suit who was walking into the club was indeed Charles Lindbergh." I've had Dr. Marcel on my show several times, and it's pretty weird stuff. I'll give you another quote here. "I didn't know what we were picking up. I still don't know what it was. It could not have been part of aircraft, nor part of any kind of weather balloon or experimental balloon. I've seen rockets set up at White Sands testing grounds. It definitely was not part of an aircraft, missile, or rocket." Analysis conducted by Dr. John Watkins in May 1990, Jesse Marcel Jr. remembers being awakened by his father that night and following him outside to help carry in a large box filled with debris. Once inside, they emptied the contents of the debris onto the kitchen floor. Jesse Jr. described the lead foil and I-beams. Under hypnosis, he recalled writing on the I-beams as purple. Strange, never saw anything like it. different geometric shapes, leaves, and circles. Under questioning, Jesse said the symbols were shiny purple and they were small. There are many separate figures. This, too, was under hypnosis. Marcel Jr. saying it was a flying saucer. I asked him what a flying saucer is. I don't know what a flying saucer is. It's a ship. Dad's excited. This is what he said under hypnosis. They collected as much material as would fit into the vehicle to take back to the base. Marcel, however, decided to stop by his house before returning to the base, woke up his wife and 11-year-old son, Jesse. And it was about 1 a.m. to show him the material. Some of the material was brought into the kitchen, spread on the floor, and examined. Jesse later described the material as being three types. Small I-beam material with writing on it. Very thin material material today, which would be referred to as Bakelite or plastic material. According to witnesses, the handle of the material, the thin material, could not be burned, torn, or dented, and when crumpled up, returned to its original shape in a few seconds, showing no creases. Both Major Marcel and son Jesse are two of the most credible witnesses in the whole Roswell witness incident, in my opinion. Okay. So, exactly why, once again, why was Charles Lindbergh in Roswell at that time? Another eyewitness to this mystery is a gentleman named Earl L. Zimmerman. And we are going to read from something called the Zimmerman Affidavit. This is something that he swore to in front of officials that this occurred. Mr. Zimmerman worked at the Bay Roswell, and I do have the full affidavit here on file. And I received this email from Stanton Freeman, who states, I haven't seen the Zimmerman item in many years. Seems to me that it may have dealt with a supposed confusion on the part of Lou Rickett and his work with Lincoln LaPaz. I don't recall the details, don't know Zimmerman, so I can't express an opinion. I should add that everybody makes some mistakes, especially when dealing with events of long ago. In the Zimmerman affidavit, he states that he, quote, at about the time I saw the Air Force commander, General Roger Ramey, in the officers' club more than once. On a couple of these occasions, he had Charles Lindbergh with him. I heard that they were on the base because of the flying saucer business. There was no publicity about Lindbergh's visits. I was very surprised to see him in the club. I think he came to Roswell with Ramey. I seem to recall that one of these occasions, Ramey had flown in from Puerto Rico. Okay. So where do we go with this? Where do we take this, guys? We need to have more investigation. We have affidavits from literally hundreds of people on this story. Hundreds of people. And yet, nobody's researched this part of the case. It seems that Lindbergh was involved in foreign aircraft technologies. He was a part of that Kilner-Lindbergh board. This was established by General Hap Arnold. I had a nickname. To revise military characteristics of all U.S. military aircraft, including the B-29 design in the AAF five-year program. We found this board is composed of General W.C. Kilner, Charles A. Lindbergh, Colonel Carl Spatz, and Naden and Major Lyon. General Henry H. Hap Arnold, the acting head of the Army Air Corps, has become alarmed by the growing war clouds in Europe and the Japanese military campaigns in China. Established a special committee chaired by this Brigadier General W.G. Kilner to make recommendations for long-term needs of the Army Air Corps. No less a personage than the famous aviator Charles Lindbergh has been a member of the committee. Lindbergh has recently toured German aircraft factories and Luftwaffe bases, and has been convinced that Germany was well ahead of the potential European adversaries. In the June 1939 report, the Kilner Committee recommended that several new long-range, medium, and heavy bombers be developed. Hastened by a new urgency caused by the outbreak of war in Europe on September 1st in 1939, November 11th, General Arnold requested authorization to contract with major aircraft companies for studies of a very long-range bomber that would be capable of carrying any future war well beyond American shores. Why was Lindbergh so interested in Roswell? Why did he sneak on base with General Ramey? Why was Lindbergh so interested in the Roswell rocket research of Dr. Goddard? Why did Don Kehoe become interested in UFOs after working with Lindbergh? These are a few of the questions from the unknown that I've come up with, and my next reports, I hope to answer this. Very interesting. I hope you guys got a little background information there on the Roswell case that maybe you didn't know, hadn't heard about. Going on to a few more cases in our last segment here of the show. October 1947, Cave Creek, Arizona. There's still one living witness in Prescott, Arizona that saw this crash. Other than that, there's not much known. March 25th, 1948, Aztec, New Mexico. I spoke at the UFO Crash Festival in Aztec, New Mexico this year. The report says still considered a hoax by most researchers. Others left the door open on this one. A new first-hand witness has been found in Las Vegas. The story is that a large disc said to be 99 feet in diameter came down in Hart Canyon, and the military recovery team was dispatched from Durango, Colorado. Well, there is evidence of a concrete stand of some kind or a foundation there that witnesses says was built by the military to support the cranes to recover this object, and the large object was recovered and removed from Hart Canyon and was transported to places unknown from there. Several witnesses were involved, including police officers, highway patrol officers from the area, and to this day we still don't know for sure what was involved in that case, exactly what happened. We're pretty sure something happened there, and I'd like to refer you to their website on this to let you look at this in report in depth. And you can go to www.aztecufo.com. That's www.aztecufo.com. And you can read all about this this crash. You can read about Frank Scully wrote called Behind the Flying Saucers, about this Aztec recovery, the limb behind it, pictures of the crash site, and what's going on up there in Aztec to this day. They celebrate this crash on a yearly basis, and they have a festival there. Looking forward to going back next year, next April. Hopefully we can help find the truth about what's going on with this thing. Alright, Aztec, that's a great story. We'll do a whole a show on the Aztec crash coming up. I wish I could talk today. Another crash that happened was March of 1948 in Socorro, New Mexico. The second crash supposedly came down in this vicinity that was much like the Aztec craft, according to an ex-Army private. August 14, 1952, reports of a disc crash near Ely, Nevada, and 16 bodies were recovered. May 20, 1953, near Kingman, Arizona. An engineer who reported this event said one or two bodies were recovered. He rode a bus with windows from the Nevada test site to the crash location. The disc was found embedded in the sand and cantered at an angle. His job was to determine the disc's trajectory and velocity. There have been rumors of additional crashes, including a controversial report of a South African Mirage jet fighter shooting a disc over the Kalahari Desert in Botswana on May 7, 1989. There are also reports of a disc crash in Chihuahua, New Mexico on August 25, 1974, and one in Megas Planetos on September 2, 1990 in Central Greece. And I hope you can understand that through my thick Oklahoma accent. I'm sorry. A few of these reports have been investigated as thoroughly as Roswell. That does not mean they should not be dismissed. These should be looked at. An FBI memo from March 22, 1950, alludes to three saucers recovered in New Mexico. This memo also states that it was believed the radar station interfered with the saucer's control mechanism, causing them to crash. If that's true, then such a discovery would suggest the idea of a weapon that could be used to bring saucers down. Now, this is an FBI memo that's on file on the FBI's website. You can go there and look at the actual memo in PDF format. Phoenix Foundation has a list of crashes that they've compiled. And probably one of the ones that more interesting ones is December 22nd, 1909. Chicago, 6 years after Kitty Hawk, newspapers from New York to Chicago were astounded by national reports of a huge airship flying across the nation and seen by thousands. It crashed west of Chicago but was never found. The story is front page news of the nation's major newspapers. And next, reports from 1933 or 34 in Ubatuba, Brazil. Witnesses on a beach are said to have seen a disc dive and explode, showering the area with silvery fragments of a highly pure magnesium. May 1947 in Spitsbergen, Norway, a report by journalist Dorothy Kilgallen states the British scientists and airmen were excavating the wreckage of a mysterious flying ship. The Swedish military announced its extraterrestrial origin and reported 17 bodies were found. The story appeared as a tiny blip for only one day in the U.S. news media before it was silenced by the military. And the reporter states, I personally saw this news story years ago. August 1948, Laredo, Texas. Four officers witnessed the crash of an object and the recovery of bodies 30 miles south of Laredo, Texas, in Mexico. This information came from an NBC affiliate in Chicago who received it from a source in Army Security. Now, I've heard that story also from my friend Colonel Steve Wilson, who was involved in the recovery there. I believe that to be a true incident. August 19th, 1948, Death Valley, California. Two prospectors named Mace Garney and Buck Fitzgerald claimed to have watched an object crash in the desert. It was a 24-foot disc. The story appeared on page 13 of the local Bakersfield newspaper the next day. This next one comes from sometime before 1950 in Mexico. Roy L. Dimmerick, a sales manager for the Apache Powder Company of Los Angeles, spoke with a man from Mexico and another from Ecuador who had seen a disc crash near Mexico City. April 1950, in Argentina, Mr. E.C. Bosa found a strange disc of four small dead pilots from a remote region of Argentina. He returned with a friend the next day and only found a pile of warm ashes. A cigar-shaped object was seen briefly as it flew overhead at a high altitude. And May 21st, 1953, in Birmingham, Alabama, when a disc crashed near Birmingham, the area was cordoned off and the humanoid bodies were flown to Maxwell Air Force Base, according to a man who claims to have flown the helicopter with the bodies to a waiting aircraft. Spring 54 in Maddie Dale, New York, in the suburb of Syracuse at 3 a.m. on a Sunday, an information specialist and his wife saw a 20-foot-wide object being examined on the ground by several men who were taking pictures. The next day, an officer told them the event was a military secret. Later, police denied the whole incident ever took place. 1959, Frigna, Poland. An object was reported to have fallen into the harbor. Divers recovered pieces of a shiny metal, which was examined by the Polytechnic Institute and the Polish Navy. Some material was reportedly lost. Several days later, a small humanoid was found on a nearby beach. Its remains were sent to the Soviet Union. March 6, near Pulse, New York, local law enforcement authorities capture a small humanoid outside his craft while two co-pilots escaped. The alien was turned over to the CIA and died 28 later, according to this report. November 9, 1974, Carbondale, New Jersey. A glowing object fell into a small lake outside the town. Three teenagers saw it fall at 7:30 p.m. on a Saturday. They observed a yellow-white glow under the water that shifted to a point 25 feet offshore. The boys were kept in a police car for 3 hours while a number of vehicles, floodlights, and cranes removed a disc-shaped object and put it into a van. The following Monday, a railroad lantern and battery recovered from the lake, and officials called the whole thing a hoax. May 17, 1974, Chile, New Mexico. An Air Force team allegedly removed a 60-foot-wide metallic object from an impact area and moved it to Kirkland Air Force Base. May 6, 1978, Petcaya, Bolivia. Large luminous object crashed on a 13,000-foot mountain. An expedition of soldiers and scientists were dispatched to the site, were delayed by bad weather. They found nothing. 1978, in the Soviet Union, after a collision with a Soviet fighter plane, a disc-shaped object fell to the ocean off Finland, where it was recovered with humanoid bodies by a Soviet salvage team. Now, these are just some of the reports that we've had of crashes over the last 100 years. There's been many, many more. These are just some of the highlights. And we'll probably go in depth some more. Since last episode, we talked a little bit about aircraft involvement with UFOs. I thought in this episode, we talk a little bit about crashes. And with that, we're going to probably end up this episode and give you some information on how you can contact us. Remember, Skywatch is one of the world's largest UFO groups. We're a non-profit. We do accept donations. We are also have a membership program where you can help support us. You can have a free mailing list where you can get this information emailed directly into your computer's email box, free without charge. We don't spam you. We don't give your email address out to anyone. That is free. Just go to our website, which is www.skywatch-international.org. skywatch-international.org, and we have information there. We have special reports written by our correspondents from around the world. We have audio and video files of our reports and of recent appearances we've made on several shows. Also, there's a new one I just posted on there just the other day. I was on the X-Zone show up in Canada on the 22nd of this month, and you can listen to that show live and free by going to our website and clicking on the audio video link. We've got a lot of other people's views. We have George Filer, David Twitchell being interviewed on there on our website. We have Whitley Strieber's on there, AJ Gavardi's on talking with our media expert Jerry Pippin. We've got TV interviews. I've been interviewed on the Out There T Show from Prump, Nevada. You can see our show on the History Channel about UFOs. You can see our In Search of show work. You can see our lobbyist, Steve Bassett, talking on Fox TV News. See our expert, Jim Mars, talking about the Aurora crash of 1897 for KTSA News. We've got City Rod's report on our website with video from KFR News in Oklahoma City. We've got the Mexican UFO video. We have the unknown flying thing from Channel 9 News in Oklahoma City that happened during the May 3rd tornadoes. We've got reports from all around the world here on our website. And you can go there, click on it, and listen to any of this stuff for free. It's available on our website. It's www.skywatchinternational.org. And once again, next week we will be talking about UFOs and about the alien presence and about our work to try and get to the truth. That's what this is about. That's what the show is about. That's what Skywatch is about. Dig for the truth. So if you'd like to contact me, I need to give you my contact information. You can email me at director@skywatch-international.org, or you can send a regular snail mail by U.S. mail at P.O. Box 2154. It's in Elk City, Oklahoma. The zip is 73644, and I will answer any and all emails and mails and be glad to get back to you on the subject. Well, until next week's show, as I usually say about this time, keep watching the skies. Folks, take care, and we will see you next week. Bye-bye.
It starts so innocently. You look into the sky and your life changes forever. If you think we're alone, think again. Skywatch International. Information you can trust.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others' endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning in to our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.